This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Before she became Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican representative for Georgia's 14th district, the young Marjorie Taylor was like many other teens in the 1990s. She had blonde bangs, the turtleneck sweaters. She was in the Spanish club and managed the soccer team at South Forsyth High School in Cumming, Georgia, about an hour and a half north of Atlanta. She was not involved in student government. That's according to reporting from Elena Plott Calabro of The Atlantic. Calabro had dozens of conversations with Green's friends, classmates, teachers, members in the community. And she says Green was well-liked by her classmates. They describe her as nice to everyone, upbeat, and with tons of confidence. But she didn't seem to make an impression on her teachers.
They had no recollection of her whatsoever. In fact, I can't tell you how many old faculty or staff of her high school that I talked to who said that the first time that her name kind of took meaning for them was when she started getting in the news constantly. So I have a line in the piece, you know, one teacher basically said to me, you would think that at some point there would have been like an AP government class or something, or even a campaign for student council where we would have, you know, retained some glimpse of this person, but they sincerely didn't.
No one from Green's hometown, Calabro says, expected her to become what she is today. Now, I would say that this is actually one reason why Green's political brand is so powerful. Not being an ambitious Ivy League-bound lawyer, then politician, makes, to her constituents, Marjorie Taylor Greene utterly normal. Someone they recognize and can relate to. Green was the first in her family to graduate from college, the University of Georgia. She married her college sweetheart, Perry Green. Then they moved to the Atlanta suburbs and eventually had three children. In her 30s, Green tried religion. She was baptized into a non-denominational Christian church. She also discovered CrossFit. Here's Marjorie Taylor Greene on a local Atlanta radio show in 2015.
Back in 2007, a friend of mine, she asked me, she said, do you want to try out this crazy underground cult fitness thing called CrossFit?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. Did the workout the best we knew how, and I loved it. I fell in love with it. It was like the hardest thing I ever did, and it was the greatest thing I ever did.
Green felt powerful, grounded, and focused by CrossFit. At one time, she ranked 47th in the entire United States for her age group. She set her sights on the CrossFit Games, the sport's biggest competition, and later she opened her own CrossFit gym. However, Green never made it to the CrossFit Games. Calabro says Green's life instead took a sudden turn. She reportedly had two separate affairs with men she met at the gym, her marriage was in trouble, and she ultimately sold her stake in her CrossFit business.
Every human being goes through this, I think, at some point in life, which is to say, kind of feeling unmoored, unsure what your purpose is. I mean, it's why, you know, midlife crisis is such a cliche. I do think that Marjorie Taylor Greene went through her own version of that in her late 30s and early 40s. I think essentially she sort of had a break where she said, I've got to find something new. I feel totally adrift in life. And that was when, according to people close to her that I spent a lot of time with, she found QAnon. And specifically, she found the Save the Children hashtag.
The Save the Children hashtag is one co-opted by conspiracy theorists who believe, without evidence, that a network of celebrities and government officials are running a child sex trafficking ring. In other words, Marjorie Taylor Greene fell down the QAnon rabbit hole. But in the 2016 election, Greene did not vote for Donald Trump. In fact, she didn't vote for anyone. Soon after, though, Marjorie Taylor Greene became one of the MAGA movement's biggest voices. Here she is in January of 2019, calling for a protest in Washington.
In Washington, D.C., on February 23rd, and protest and march with me at 8 a.m. Really? Please, I'm begging you. If we have a sea of people, if we shut down the streets, if we shut down everything, if we flood the Capitol building, flood all the government buildings, go inside. These are public buildings. We own them. We own these buildings.
Fast forward to the present day, and Marjorie Taylor Greene is entering now her second term in Congress. She's become a potent force for connecting the Republican Party to the far right, and she is poised to wield much more power in the new Republican-controlled House. So what will she do with that power? We want to understand more deeply Marjorie Taylor Greene today. And to help us do that is Tia Mitchell. She's the Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tia, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much.
Robert Draper is also with us. He's a staff writer at the New York Times and author most recently of Weapons of Mass Delusion, When the Republican Party Lost Its Mind. And in the process of reporting that book, Robert Draper spent some 15 months following and speaking with Representative Greene. So, Robert, welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having me, Magna.
I also just want to note for everyone that we did reach out to Representative Greene's office about coming on the show or speaking with us in any capacity. They did not respond. Now, I just want to jump first and foremost to a question which, after going through that sort of brief history of Representative Greene's background, leading to her embrace of QAnon, many people want to know, how much does she actually believe the things she says about those conspiracy theories? I mean, from your experience covering her, and Tia, I'll start with you, do you know how to answer that?
You know, it's hard to get to know for sure what's in the mind of any individual that's not yourself. But I will say, based on my observation over the past several years, I do think she believes it. I think kind of how you set it up, she fell down the QAnon rabbit hole. She's like many Americans who became susceptible to these far-right conspiracy theories. Now, I think the bigger question for Marjorie Greene is, as she gets exposed to truth and exposed to information and exposed to history, she becomes more accountable for those conspiracy theories. And she needs to be held more accountable for holding on to things that, perhaps unlike the average person on Facebook, she does have the truth. She has people at her beck and call who are saying, no, these things are not accurate. And does she continue to double down? And a lot, and sometimes she says, okay, well, now I understand that what I thought wasn't true. But in a lot of ways, she still continues to proliferate conspiracy theories.
Yeah. So, Robert, let me turn to you on that, because it makes me wonder whether or not she fully believes some of the things that she says. Does it actually matter? Because as Tia's pointing out, perhaps the most important thing to know is that she's still just proliferating them and politically using these theories and the kind of language that she employs.
Well, it may be a distinction without a difference. You're right. I think the answer is that she believes enough of what she's saying. You used the phrase, does she fully believe? And no, I don't think she fully believes. She believes at bottom that the radical left in the form of the Democratic Party is chipping away at the America that people like she has known and revered all their lives. At the same time, there is an attention economy that incentivizes outrageous rhetoric and behavior, and Greene is well aware of that too. So she told me that she hyperbolizes for effect. She said a few months ago that Democrats want Republicans dead and the killings have already begun. She doesn't really believe that, but she believes that Democrats demonize Republicans. The way to get online donations, the way to increase your social media following is to say the more extreme version of what she believes.
You know, I have to say, Robert, just as an aside, it's remarkable to me that she even agreed to spend as much time as she did with you in all these one-on-one conversations, given how she goes out of her way, and other Republicans to just, viciously malign the so-called mainstream media. Were you surprised about the fact that you got so much access?
I mean, it took a year, so it wasn't like it was handed to me on a silver platter. I mean, it was a year of showing up to her public events, of going into her district, of then getting to know her aides and chatting with them off the record and then on background. And finally, 1 year later, they arranged for me to have an off-the-record lunch with her in her district in Rome, Georgia. Georgia. And I think that it was surprising for her, having never met anybody from the New York Times before, but having said so many negative things about the Times, that, you know, I wasn't emitting sulfur fumes, that I had a Southern accent like she did. And that further, at the end of our off-the-record conversation, I didn't breach the agreement by putting it all out on Twitter or something. So she then agreed bit by bit to chat with me more, and we still talk to this day.
Okay. You know, so what I'd like to get from both of you as we head towards our first break is it's often possible in, you know, I'd say especially in broadcast media, that that people become flattened into, you know, two-dimensional, almost caricatures. But since you've both spent so much time with her, Tia, what is Representative Green actually like in person?
Well, I thought it was interesting when you talked about the people who remember her from her childhood described her as nice, upbeat, confident. Those are words I would use as well. Like, in one-on-one interactions, particularly when there are not cameras around, this is off-the-record, private interactions. She is pretty nice to me personally as a reporter who covers her. But I think, you know, to Robert's point, she tends to turn things up when, quote unquote, people are watching. And then she will attack the media. She's attacked me. But again, she's attacked me and then turned around a week later and been nice again. So it's, I know people want to vilify her, and they've seen her say ugly things. They've seen her act in a not great way to her colleagues, to Democratic activists. And those things are true and should not be dismissed. I'm not trying to sugarcoat. But in private moments, she can be a very sweet, bubbly person, even to people that she would normally publicly not always be the way with.
Right. And actually, I appreciate you saying that because, it, you know, we're trying to understand today, like, what is she actually all about? Right. How much to how do we interpret her public statements and what her goals are, especially as she becomes newly empowered with the incoming Republican-controlled House. So Tia Mitchell and Robert Draper, much more to learn from your reporting in just a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are trying to understand more deeply Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. And I'm joined by Robert Draper. He's a staff writer at The New York Times, author of the new book, Weapons of Mass Delusion, When the Republican Party Lost Its Mind. And Tia Mitchell is with us as well. She's Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Now, I want to talk more about you know, trying to understand what Representative Greene actually does believe and how she might carry those beliefs forward into this next Congress. And one way to do that is to just look back and remember the things that she has said, a couple of things she said about that January 6, 2021 attack on the Congress, attack on the certification of the Electoral College. I mean, here is a Facebook video from the Capitol on January 6th, and here's part of what Representative Greene said.
For all the great people, wonderful Americans who support President Trump that are here in Washington, D.C. today, I urge you to remain calm. I urge you to have a peaceful protest. Make sure that everyone is safe and protected, and let's do this in a peaceful manner.
That's then newly elected Representative Greene on January 6, 2021. But just this past weekend, Representative Greene said this at an event sponsored by the New York Young Republicans Club, where many white supremacists were in attendance.
Then January 6 happens, and next thing you know, I organized the whole thing along with Steve Bannon here. And I want to tell you something. If Steve Bannon and I had organized that, we would have won. Not to mention, it would have been armed.
So there's some jokes there about the attack on American democracy. Tia, you were actually with Representative Green on that day. Can you tell us what happened and what that was like?
Yes. As you mentioned, she was a newly minted member of Congress only 3 days in. And after members of Congress and the media got evacuated from the House gallery when the Capitol was under attack, immediately after evacuation, I ran into her and I went up to her. And the first thing she did was ask me if I was okay. She was very concerned about both of our safety. And then, you know, I said, well, you know, do you have anything you want to say? And she reiterated very similar to what we just heard in that recording. She wanted people to be safe. She condemned the violence. I felt, you know, her demeanor was that of concern. We know that she was involved in Stop the Steal efforts, but I got the sense that the violence of the day took her by surprise and that she was scared.
Mm-hmm. Now, Robert, you've also talked with her subsequently about what happened that day. What did she tell you?
Yeah, the same thing that Tia just conveyed. She was genuinely terrified about what took place in the Capitol, and we know in real time was sending Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows texts saying this isn't the way to solve things. Now, Green has subsequently said to me that she was chagrined to learn that the FBI had all this advanced intelligence of violent actors who were going to come to the Capitol, and she had said, you know, if only the FBI had shared this information with folks like me, because I could have used my very large platform to dissuade attendees who follow me, Marjorie Taylor Greene, from engaging in any kind of violence. But apart from that one video that she posted, Greene's Twitter account fell strangely silent that afternoon. And though she was afraid for her life, afraid for the safety of others, she did not use everything that she could bring to bear on the situation to try to quell the mob.
Yeah. So here's actually a one really potent example of where that the overlap between belief and practice makes me wonder that, you know, she's also said, you know, she didn't condone the violence on that day while simultaneously loudly complaining about the people who were being prosecuted for having attacked Congress, you know, since then, that they're, you know, she says they're being treated unfairly by the justice system. And in her mind, those two things do not, they're not mutually exclusive thoughts. But what I wonder is, you know, in reading both of your reporting about this, I feel like this is actually a very common right-wing sleight of hand. Because by saying, you know, on the one hand, people aren't being treated fairly in the justice system, but on the other hand, I don't condone the violence of that day. What both of those things accomplish is actually distracting from the real point, which was the quote-unquote Stop the Steal effort, right? Which was the effort to undermine a fair and legitimate election of now President Joe Biden, that like a complete just denial of the legitimacy of the democratic process. So Robert, I mean, how much does Green actually believe in democracy?
Sure. Well, I mean, the answer to your question involves two delusions. The first delusion is that the election was stolen, something that Marjorie Taylor Greene believes to this day. She said to me a couple of months ago, Robert, you don't honestly believe that Joe Biden got 81 million votes, do you? And I was surprised that that really was the sum total of her argument as to how the election therefore must have been stolen. But the other delusion is this notion, and it's a common talking point. We've been hearing it for decades, literally from the Rush Limbaughs and Sean Hannitys of talk radio, that it is the left that engages in violence and that conservatives do not do so. And therefore, it follows that if you saw violence from Trump supporters on January the 6th, it was only because they were stirred up by someone. This could have been Antifa. It could have been violent actors who were lodged there by the FBI. And so this goes then to Green's argument that political persecution has taken place, that there are some people who got sucked into the violence, probably through no fault of their own, seems to be her way of thinking about it, and now they are languishing in the D.C. jail, proof that there is some two-tiered system of justice, but not the two-tiered system of justice many of us have been aware of who cover the criminal justice system. Instead, in her belief, there is a system of justice for Trump voters and then a system of justice for everyone else.
Okay. Well, what I'd like to do now, is Tia, and I'm going to rely on you for this, is help us understand how and why so much of this seems to resonate with her constituents who sent her back to Congress. So first of all, here's an example of one of the things that Marjorie Taylor Greene has said, and this is actually even before she became a member of the House. This is from 2018, and she's promoting conspiracy theories at the American Priority Conference, which Politico has described as a CPAC-style conference for the MAGA set.
President Trump is the first president in a very long time that is not deep state controlled. That's why you see all of these forces, the media, Democrats big time, some Republicans, liberal judges, court systems, foreign governments, CEOs, elites. You see many people coming against Donald Trump because he is not part of the deep state and he doesn't play along to their agenda.
So that's Green in 2018. Tia, tell us about Georgia's 14th district. I mean, who lives there? What's it like? And some of the reasons why messages like this that Representative Green sends out seems to resonate.
So Georgia's 14th district is Northwest Georgia. So it's like the corner of Georgia closest to Tennessee. And it's pretty rural, even though, well, I should say, starting in January, the district now, because of gerrymandering, actually goes all the way down to include some parts of metro Atlanta, Cobb County, to be specific. Uh-huh. But mostly it's Northwest Georgia. Mostly it's rural. It's very conservative, even with the gerrymandering. It's Republican-leaning, so much so that it's nearly impossible for a Democrat to win. That being said, I feel that voters, and let's focus on the conservative voters in the 14th district that are the majority. We know that there are Democrats in the 14th district, particularly in cities like Rome, that don't support Marjorie Taylor Greene. But again, they're outnumbered. Among the Republicans, when I talk to them, they fall in, I would say, three separate camps. There's a small minority of Republicans, and this is true, I would say, these are the same that we would hear when we talk to people about Herschel Walker or Donald Trump, these three camps of Republicans. There's one Republican camp that's like, some of our leaders have gone too far with the MAGA stuff, and I'm done. I can't support them. I don't like it. This isn't the party that this is not my Republican Party. This isn't the Reagan and McCain Republican Party. Those Republicans are in the minority. And then I would say the rest of the party splits into two camps. There's the ultra MAGA camp that, again, we hear this with Trump. They say, we love it. There are people who love Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's speaking exactly to them. They believe the conspiracy theories. They think all Democrats are evil. They think Donald Trump was kind of there and was vilified because he represented a different brand of politics. They're all in with Marjorie Taylor Greene. They love what she says. They love that Democrats have vilified her because that to them means she's doing the right thing. And then in the middle, there are Republicans who will say, you know, I don't love everything Marjorie Taylor Greene says, but I still agree with her in principle. Or I agree with her enough that even though some of the conspiracy theories are too far for me, I still support her. I still think Democrats should back off. And so with two of the three camps, that's still a coalition that she'll win, you know, probably every time she's on the ballot.
I see. Okay, so with that coalition, then, there seems to be little to no consequence for many of the things she has said in the past and continues to say. We've got some more examples here. This is 2019, again, before she became a member of Congress, and Green confronted Parkland school shooting survivor and gun control advocate David Hogg in Washington. He was outside one of the legislative offices in D.C.
David, why are you supporting the red flag laws? If there had been, if Scott Peterson, the resource officer at Parkland, had done his job, then Nicholas Cruz wouldn't have killed anybody in your high school, or at least protected them. Why are you supporting red flag gun laws that attack our Second Amendment rights?
So that's from 2019. And then in a series of Facebook videos that she posted between 2017 and 2019, which were obtained by Politico, Green says, you know, a lot of racist, Islamophobic, and anti-Semitic things, including this.
There is an Islamic invasion into our government offices right now. You know, they want to put their hand on the Quran and be sworn in. No, you have to be sworn in on the Bible. Now, yes, we have, I'll say this, we have freedom of religion in this country that protects anyone to have, you know, have any kind of a religion that they want. But I'm sorry, anyone that is a Muslim that believes in Sharia law does not belong in our government.
That's Marjorie Taylor Greene in a Facebook post before 2019. Robert Draper, she said that she wasn't really political, you know, before 2016 or so. I mean, how do you explain the conversion, if I can put it that way, from being a CrossFit enthusiast businesswoman to basically saying that there's an Islamic invasion infiltrating the U.S. government?
Sure. It's, I mean, she, you know, what basically happened was that through the CrossFit community, the greater community online, she became exposed to the QAnon community. And that, up until that point, she had donated, I think, once to Trump's presidential campaign, maybe 5 weeks before he actually won. So you're right that her views weren't very pronounced until she began to see the state of America in these kind of existential terms laid out by QAnon. Now, what's remarkable about what you were just playing, Meghna, was not just what Green actually did and said. What's remarkable is that you have access to those, and the reason that you do is that Green's campaign never took them down. And when I asked her, why didn't you take those down? Surely you must knew that you must have known how they would harm your campaign. And she said, no, in fact, I didn't think they would hurt my campaign at all. I thought that might help my campaign, which goes to show you again of what the mind meld that she has with her constituents. And I would say that those constituents extend well beyond the 14th district of non-college educated white working class voters. And if you go into her office, you'll see the walls festooned with literally hundreds of fan notes. And if you look at them closely, they're from all over the nation. They're not from Georgia at all. And they're people who, they're essentially love letters to the MAGA cause. So the kinds of things they would write to Donald Trump. And they see Green as the proximate warrior to Trump now that he has left Washington. They see her as their fighter. And so those beliefs, you know, as abhorrent as they may seem to us, are in fact embraced by people in a larger community. And I'd also just add to what Tia had said about the Republicans in Georgia, is that even those who may not always approve, as Tia is saying, of some of the things that Green says and does on social media, they have the same enemies. You know, the vilification of Marjorie Taylor Greene upsets them more maybe than they love Marjorie Taylor Greene herself.
You know, that's really interesting. There's one thing that I should add about her embrace of QAnon, and that is that in February 2021, the then democratically controlled House voted to strip her of her committee assignments because she, you know, of many of the things that she had said. She consequently tried to disavow her connection with QAnon, and she said she regrets it and she has stopped believing in it. So I want to put that out there. But Tia Mitchell, again, we're heading towards our next break. But on a day-to-day basis, when Representative Green is, you know, doing the work of a congressperson, how much of her efforts are focused on these sort of ultra-MAGA things versus the sort of, bread-and-butter things that she could do for her constituents back in Georgia?
Well, and that's kind of an offshoot, a byproduct of Democrats stripping her of committees, is she had more time to focus on the MAGA and the culture wars because she didn't have the burden of, like, keeping up with legislation, going to committee meetings and hearings. So between that, the only other thing that as a congresswoman she could do in official capacity was, you know, the constituent services and the retail politics of attending events in her district. From what I can tell, she handled that, you know, on average basis. People who love her think that, you know, she shows up and she does the barbecues and rallies and things like that. But otherwise, she was free to circle the country talking about these issues because she didn't have anything official to do in Washington. Huh.
Tia Mitchell with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Robert Draper with the New York Times. More to talk with you, talk about with you when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tia Mitchell and Robert Draper are with us today, and we're talking about Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. Robert, you know, it's remarkable the speed with which Representative Greene has gone from becoming, you know, sort of this fringe ultra-MAGA freshman congressperson to now becoming, you know, more Trump than Trump. I'm not even sure she even needs him anymore. And because of the, you know, the tight majority that the Republican Party will have in the incoming Congress, she stands to wield, you know, a lot of influence, possibly even sitting on House oversight. So what will she, what has she told you that she plans to do with this new influence?
Well, you know, for starters, as you just referenced, Meghna, there will be a lot of investigations, she has promised. And yes, that's Jamie Comer, who's likely to be the head of the Oversight Committee, has already said that Greene is welcome on that committee. And so she will be spearheading investigations into the Biden family, into other cabinet agencies that she feels like have committed this or that malfeasance. We can certainly expect that. It seems likely that they will try to initiate an impeachment inquiry, and she will be very much behind that. It seems likely as well, since Greene has been promulgating this, that an audit of the money that has been used to fund the efforts of Ukraine to fight the Russians may well lead to cutting off monies entirely for that effort. And then we'll see, you know, if there will be, for example, another, you know, government shutdown, or for that matter, an inability to raise the debt ceiling. I mean, I think that Greene is very indisposed to fund the government, and very indisposed to raising the debt ceiling. So, so there are a lot of those things that we can expect under a Republican majority in which Greene is a key player.
Yeah. So, you know, you've also reported that Marjorie Taylor Greene has become one of the best fundraisers for the Republican Party, and money speaks for sure. But what does her rapid ascent now and her close proximity to, you know, Kevin McCarthy, what does it say about how much of what she actually represents has become the core of what the House Republicans are all about?
Well, it's, I mean, the core of the Republican Party is still the MAGA base. It's impossible to say whether or not they constitute a majority. It's very easy to say that they constitute the loudest voices in the room. Kevin McCarthy is afraid of those voices. He does not want to cross them, just like no one wants to denounce Marjorie Taylor Greene in the party because you're just picking a fight you don't want to have. You mentioned that Marjorie Taylor Greene may not even need Donald Trump anymore. Well, maybe she doesn't, but what she doesn't need is Donald Trump as an enemy. And they view Marjorie Taylor Greene in the same way, and that's why she's being placated in the manner that she is.
Well, we've just got about 30 seconds left, Tia. And talk to me about what you're going to be looking for in terms of what Representative Greene does or her goals for the incoming Congress.
We'll be following her closely. I think we'll be following how she interacts with this new district that does have more Democrats than what she's used to representing. But like Robert said, we'll be looking to see where she leads these investigations and how she uses this new platform that she will be given under Republican leadership that will legitimize her in a new way.
Well, Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, it was great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Robert Draper, staff writer at the New York Times. Newest book is Weapons of Mass Delusion, When the Republican Party Lost Its Mind. Robert, great to have you as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.